Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Remember a time when central banks pretended to be independent? Is that actually a good thing? The fact that they say they control the economy and yet they are unelected. Is that a good starting point unless you believe their decisions are based on irrefutable science? Yeah, right. But that aside, has their independence disappeared this year with the coronavirus? And does that mean they'll never go back? Well, look at that. Today on the Debunking Economics podcast with Professor Steve Keen, I'm Phil Dobby. Welcome along. So as debt from COVID-19 racks up, Steve, I'm hearing a lot of regular people, not economists, just normal people, saying that government debt is going to be written off somehow. There's this assumption that, you know, if it keeps on rising, somehow it's just not going to be paid. And I think that's because people have got used to this idea now. They've heard in the news the term quantitative easing. So I think in most people's minds, the government issues debt, the central bank buys it up and it ends there. And I just wonder whether that's accepted wisdom now. I don't think people fully understand the process, but people are now thinking, oh, you know, there's no way the government's going to insist that that they have to pay the money back. It's all just going to be written off. It'd be nice if that happened, wouldn't it? But I don't think the government or the central banks see it that way.
No, you've got the because the people they listen to aren't the people on the street, they're the people on Wall Street. Mm. And in that world, if you did that, you wipe out the value of their assets because a lot of that debt is owned by the financial sector. So to talk about writing the debt off also means writing off their asset, and they're not about to entertain that in a hurry.
But if through quantitative easing those assets have been bought by the central bank, then they're not losing out, are they?
Well, when you got QE and you're actually getting them to buy government bonds directly, not QE, but what they're doing with maybe called QC, quantitative COVID, but with that, the central bank is directly buying the treasury bond, so it completely bypasses the private sector borrowing, and therefore, you know, it's a classic case of the government being in debt to itself, and I think that's probably why people are making the very genuinely logical leap to say, well, it doesn't really matter anyway, does it? Because we owe it to ourselves. If the government owes it to itself, it can just cancel it out. It nets out to zero. But in the meantime, by creating it, we're actually putting money into the private sector, so we're benefiting from it. So in that weird sort of way, it's a weird lesson about MMT.
Well, I mean, how far? We're not actually that far from it, are we? So if bonds are issued, then bought by the Bank of England, the interest paid on those coupons for the duration that the Bank of England is holding onto them, I mean, surely that's not going to make much difference because that is the Treasury paying back the Bank of England. That's like me paying a loan back to myself.
And I think in the case of the British system, the Treasury doesn't have to pay interest on any bonds that are owned by the central bank.
Countries
that require it, anyway. Then you pay it back. Yeah, so there's
yeah, but I mean, either way, it's just bookkeeping. I mean, it's a nonsense if you pay it back because you own the bank anyway. Mm. But if you get so you're halfway there to MMT. So the only question is, what happens at the end when those bonds mature? If they're still held by the Bank of England, what happens at that point? And I guess they would say, well, okay, again, it's the same deal, isn't it? You know, the Treasury has to pay the Bank of England, but the Treasury owns the Bank of England. So
it'll roll over the debt.
Mm. Yeah, they just roll it over. So if it's not passed back onto the open market, if they don't try and reduce their balance sheet and they just accept that, you know, maybe it's a three-year maturation, when you get to the end of that 3 years, if those have been bought by the central bank, that's MMT, isn't it? I mean, it's just the process to get there is a little bit long and convoluted. And is it really impacting the financial sector? Not really, because the bonds that they owned for a short time went back to the Bank of England, or went to the Bank of England, their involvement in the whole process stopped.
And they also get a, because the Bank of England's buying the bonds, not just the ones they're buying directly of Treasury, but buying others off the central, off the financial sector as well. The financial sector is getting money, which with no return, in return for bonds with a positive return. They've made a capital gain on selling the bonds, but, they now have to get income out of the new assets, non-income earning assets they've got. So what they do, of course, is go and buy shares. And that's partly where the cake. And of course, the money when they bought it, the money that they buy is redeposited back on the reserves again, so they can't get rid of it. It's the classic hot potato effect comes back at you. But yeah, that's had a huge impact on the financial sector in its favour, which is one reason again why they wouldn't be too fond of seeing that scheme come to an end.
But does it make any difference whether the bonds were ever issued? I mean, what's the difference between the bonds being issued and then just disappearing into the Bank of England versus those bonds just not being issued at all and the Treasury just having run an overdraft with the Bank of England? As far as the finance sector, does it change too much?
No, not at all. And that's the thing. The only real function of selling bonds to the financial sector is so that the Treasury can maintain a non-negative bank balance at the central bank, which it owns. I mentioned you've been in overdraft and sometimes in your small business career.
I've been
the same, and it just means you pay, rather than getting a positive interest rate, you get a larger negative one that goes to the bank on your deposit account. And you try like blazes to reduce it because it's more expensive and you face all sorts of consequences. But if you owned the bank, you wouldn't give a damn about it. And that's the situation the Treasury is in. It could run a negative balance and it could even tell the central bank not to worry about it and nobody'd be any the wiser.
So the big question, though, which is what I wanted to talk about today, is if you're in that situation, then, basically the government and the Bank of England are colluding, aren't they, on monetary policy and fiscal policy, and they're supposed to be independent of each other. I mean, the argument would be from central banks is that we manage loans, we don't issue debt. I mean, they would be issuing debt in that scenario, and monetary policy and fiscal policy would be in collusion with each other, which, of course, is happening anyway with COVID. I mean, it's a nonsense to think that they're operating independently of each other right now.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, this is another case where reality has put a large blow into what was seen as institutional arrangements, but are actually ideology that the bank should be independent. The whole reason, well, there's two reasons. The politicians themselves loved the idea of central bank independence because it meant they would themselves no longer carry the opprobrium for putting up interest rates when that was what the normal thing with the government was doing back in the inflationary late 60s and 70s through to 80s. So the governments then were happy to hand over the negative of putting up interest rates. Now in the opposite world, interest rates are falling. And it's because the central banks thought they were the experts. They wanted to do it as well. They thought they knew how the economy operated and their confidence was blasted out of the water by the financial crisis. And they still don't know what they're doing in the aftermath.
So how does currency play into all of this? If we've got isn't there a danger? If a country that issues lots of new currency as a matter of course, but investors are locked out of buying the government's bond in the open market because they're all being bought up by the central bank. Like gilts, for example, hard to get because the Bank of England is snaffling them all up. Then I'd imagine that would mean that what's left would be relatively expensive. And what does that do for currencies? Because they do all play. I mean, the purchases of bonds is a big driver of a big influence of inflows and outflows into a country, and therefore has a big impact on the currency. And obviously, the impact on the currency has an impact on the value of or the cost of exports and imports for that country. Obviously economics is a complex system. I'm just interested in the broader play. That's the understatement of the decade, isn't it?
I think
but I'm
so.
Just interested in the broader play between bond markets and currencies, and how if the government isn't issuing enough bonds, how that's influencing the flow of money in and out of their country.
Well, let's take Japan as our example there, which has been issuing bonds willy-nilly for 30 years now and is still able to do it and still hasn't had to make an international sale of its bonds because although they're bought domestically in Japan. So the problem of this having an impact on the currency comes out of running a trade deficit. And of course, that's what the UK does do, and America, and normally Australia, not Europe, but they don't have their own central bank anyway. It's a national level central bank. So several of the countries that have been doing this are well insulated by their trade surpluses. Others, the problem is not that they're running a deficit, it's that they've got a trade deficit.
But you've got to issue some bonds, haven't you, for people who want to buy your currency. So when we hear that there's a rush towards the yen because it's a safe haven currency, and I guess it's only a safe haven currency because of that trade surplus, that people know that they're still producing stuff and there's money still coming into the country. People are buying those bonds, though, aren't they?
They're buying those bonds.
So you've got to have those bonds available for foreigners to buy. You can't. Your central bank can't buy all of them. You've got to issue some on the open market.
Yeah, I mean, that's partially the salve to QE, that you have to have them here anyway to some extent. Taking them out of circulation actually gets to be a problem because the financial sector markets wants to have those as part of their portfolio, both for hedging reasons. But the last thing the private banking sector wants to see government debt disappear, which is ironic because a lot of people in the financial sector are also people who reckon there should be no government debt. So it's ideology and reality crashing, and as usual, ideology wins.
Or maybe they don't understand the system. I mean, that's a you've made the point before.
It was such an accusation.
You've made the point that you can work right in the heart of it, but you still don't understand what's surrounding you. Look, Stephanie Kelton's excellent book, which I did enjoy because it's so accessible, isn't it?
She
made the point that you made, that the only reason governments issue bonds is to maintain the illusion of being financially constrained. So if we didn't issue them, then the bond investors would lose out. They wouldn't earn interest. And what would they do with their money? As you said, they'd probably inflate share prices and house prices. So it's not such a good thing. So there has to be a level, doesn't there, for the reasons we've outlined, for that reason, and also, something for people to buy when they're buying into your currency. You've got to get there's a balance there. So that's the role of the central bank, surely, to try and say, well, okay, out of all of the debt that's been issued by the government, we've got to find the right balance. It's a job for them to try and find a job for the central bank if the Treasury's doing it all. But maybe their job is to say, well, okay, we've got to work out to maintain and to try and make sure that we're not getting asset price inflation in other areas. We've got to work out what proportion of those bonds that we issue go out onto the open market.
Yeah, and then that's a functional role for the central bank rather than a management role. Because when they said they wanted for central bank independence, it also ran with the development of the, first of all, the new classical and then the so-called new Keynesian approach to macro, where the central bank played a central role because its interest rate changes control the level of the economy and inflation. And in that situation, they wanted to have, not so much the bond issuing side of things, because they're all anti deficits to begin with, most mainstream economists, in an ideological way. They're not really all that aware of it, but yeah, they're anti government debt. But they wanted to set the interest rate. Now that's going well beyond what politicians thought they were agreeing to when they agreed to independence, because you want independence for the sort of functions you're talking about. But not the type of thing where they're trying to control the economy as if they are the only ones who know how to do it.
Because the other thing they're trying to control, supposedly, is inflation. But that's not a... I mean, if the government is there... I mean, depends on what you think causes inflation, whether it's wages that's pushing inflation or whether it's the supply of money. But if the government is in charge of the supply of money because they're using it to determine through modern monetary theory how much they create based on how much they're prepared to spend, then they're in charge of inflation on that basis, aren't they?
Well, I mean, the central banks thought they were in charge of it because that's what their real business cycle model told them was the case, that the interest rate was the thing which controlled the inflation rate and the output gap, as they call it in their models. So they really thought central bank independence was a cover for letting neoclassical economists run the economy, where those economists began with the belief that the interest rate was the only control variable that mattered and the deficit, if anything, was a negative. So I'm happy to, I'm anti that form of central bank independence because it's giving independent power to a bunch of economists who don't understand the economy they're supposedly managing. And that's what I think would have been a real danger of all this. If they actually understood, if their model was correct, if their model was a correct description of how capitalism functions, we wouldn't be having this conversation at all, nor would we be having the crises that have occurred since they managed to get supreme control back in the mid-80s.
Right. So really, inflation should be controlled by the Treasury then. If we're going down the MMT road, they'd control inflation based on how much money they're spending and how many jobs they're creating.
Yeah. I mean, if you had to look at what actually helps cause inflation, and on this front, it's more complex than just saying it's the government's scale of the deficit, which is one of the ways of creating money into the economy. I've been just taking on that line that I've developed recently of saying you could derive macro from macro itself to including inflation in a model with not just real output, but nominal output as well. And it turned out that the rate of growth of the inflation equation was money wages minus changes in the distribution of income minus labor productivity. And I got quite a surprise when I saw the sign that came out for the wages share of income. It was negative. Increase in the wages share would actually reduce inflation. But it turns out that indicator of the wages share of GDP is actually the markup that capitalists put on output when you look at an overall pricing equation. I know I'm getting pretty hairy here, pardon me, but I just want to finish with it. It's distribution of income effects that cause inflation, not the interest rate, and not so much demand pressures that does turn up in the wage setting, which is determined by the level of economic activity in the economy, but the level of output. And the level of employment helps determine what the wage rate is. So you do have inflation coming in that direction from the level of economic activity, but a large part of it is the combination of struggles over the distribution of income, and workers mm-hmm. have lost out really badly over that in the last 30 years, and that's partly why we've had deflation.
Right, and is why when just before Margaret Thatcher came into power, we were seeing and really. Why she came into power was because we were seeing large-scale inflation in the UK. I mean, up to, you know, reaching 25%, I think, at one stage. And the unions were particularly strong. The miners were on strike. You know, we had the three-day week. You know, the miners really pushing hard to try and get their wages higher. Strangely, the response from Margaret Thatcher on that was listening to Milton Friedman was that, well, you know, it's obvious how we need to control that. We need to control the money supply.
The policy that was taken both in the UK and America was on the belief that if you simply put up the rate of interest, you would ultimately reduce inflationary expectations and cause inflation to fall, and it would be a sort of short, sharp adjustment of people's expectations rather than a serious downturn. In fact, both of them caused massive recessions, which weakened the power of organized labor and led to the situation we're in now of permanent deflation.
So I'm still trying to figure out in all of this then, if we went down an MMT road, what are the targets for the government and what's the target for the central bank? Or is the future really to actually say, well, there is no independence, there is no separate job for the Bank of England. The Bank of England, you know, you can be the banker's bank, basically. You can make sure that banks don't fall over, but really the real job of managing the economy, controlling inflation and making sure that we have full employment, that's the job of the Treasury.
Yeah, I think it comes back to that. I mean, you've got to say that even in terms of any argument about democracy, the argument in favor of central bank independence and control was anti-democratic in the belief that they were the experts. Now, they've proven that's not the case. So there is an advantage.
Elected.
Yeah. Going back to the days when we say that it's the democratic principles alone, the Treasury should be where those decisions are made. And then when we understand the mechanics of money creation, and that the role that that has in determining economic activity and ultimately also potentially inflation, then that's the area where you want the discussions to be held.
But what about the setting of interest rates, which obviously very often, you know, I mean, it's a a combination of, you know, how much money is there, how many bonds are there, you know, the ability for you to buy stuff is, you know, determined by the supply of those bonds. How are we going to control interest rates in this? Or do we need to? Do we just set a flat interest rate? Because the whole international market aspect of all of this as well, if you're a country that's running MMT and others aren't, like, for example, they don't have their own sovereign currency, you know, as we were saying a little earlier, maybe there's a bit of a role for the central bank in playing on the international side of things.
Yeah, well, the central bank, you know, you certainly give it the management roles you were talking about earlier. But in terms of setting interest rate independent of other goals, no, it's subservient to other goals. And the other thing I want to control, of course, too, is the level of credit creation and the level of private debt, which are not any part of the central bank's thinking right now, but they need to be, because that's, you know, by far the major determinant of changes in the level, in the rate of economic activity, changes in credit. So I'd have several targets there, and they'd be something where there'd be, you know, practical elements would be done by the central bank, just because it's the institution set up to manage relations with the finance sector. But the decisions themselves would come from Treasury.
So under MMT, if you push money into the economy when you need it, when there's a need for stimulus, when there's a concern that the economy is running too hot and perhaps you are starting to see inflation because everybody's got a job and so they're demanding higher wages, that's actually what's driving the inflation, isn't it? It's the wage push rather than there being too much money. It's the fact that everyone's
exactly,
got a job.
Yeah. And then that's the point of that equation I talked about earlier. Yeah.
So when you get to that stage, then you do want to pull money out of the economy. Then you want to reduce demand a little bit. So that's where you'd push taxation up, presumably. That's how you pull money back out of the economy. You push taxes up.
Yeah, I've got a feeling that sort of stuff is easier to say than it is to do.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, there's one of the problems about even though it's true that if you wanted to reduce the level of activity, then you want to reduce the amount of money being created by the government. But having a differential tax rate certainly is not, I don't think it's practical or feasible as we do it at the moment. If you had like instantaneous transaction taxes and you could modify the amount of those, then maybe that might be effective. But income tax, and certainly, you know, sales tax and things like that, just too cumbersome, too slow.
Yeah.
And hard to alter on a regular basis either.
And politically quite difficult as well, because you're basically saying, hey, look, things are going so well, we're going to push taxes up right now, even though we've told you we don't need the money because we can create it. That's going to blow most people's minds, particularly when you think that that the area of the economy you're going to want to slow down is the area where money is circulating the fastest, which is going to
You'd
end up in a situation, if you follow that theory through, you're going to have to tax the poor more than you're taxing the rich because they're spending faster.
I'm trying to think of a mechanism that might work, and one might be simply having a level of money creation targeted at some moderately discretionary activity. Let's say, for example, giving everybody money they've got to spend on crowdfunding. And then when you have a decline in, when you get too much economic activity and you want to cut it back, you reduce the amount they get for crowdfunding, but that money goes into a long-term fund instead, which is there to support the entrepreneurs your previous, system has encouraged to come into operation. Because again, one of the great dangers of this is you don't want to have the trade cycle replaced by what Kolesky called the political trade cycle, having booms and slumps timed with the times of parties coming into power and so on. And that is the only argument really in favor of removing control of deficit decisions and interest rate decisions from politicians, getting away from the pork barreling temptation that exists there. So there is, in that sense, a valid reason to talk in favour of independence of policy makers. But it's gone. What it's let us do is handing over design of our rocket system to people who believe in Ptolemy's theory of astronomy. And that's what I think. If we'd done this with a economic theory that actually properly understood capitalism, I don't think we'd have quite the travities we're experiencing now.
But we would have the you know, you mentioned the lag effect. We'd still be struggling with that. Of course, central banks always use the lag effect as an excuse for why they didn't get things quite right. But it would be the same, wouldn't it, for modern monetary theory, that if you're putting too much money into the economy. Like last week, we were talking about the value of old age pensioners and how they are still consumers. And so, you know, if you gave them more money, if you doubled the amount of old age pension, then they'd spend it, and that would be good for the economy. So, in effect, we're doubling the value of old age pensioners by doubling the amount of money that we're giving them. So but if you did that, and then all of a sudden you found, oh, that was a big mistake because they are spending it, and then there's not enough of the products that they want, and so that's causing inflation. We need to pull back from that. You can't go back and say, "Oh, well, look, we want to go back and halve your pension again."
Halve your pension, yeah.
So MMT, that is the big problem, isn't it? How do you pull back from where you've gone?
Well, you don't necessarily need to go all that far. This is the other element. You know, what scale of spending do you want?
It's incrementalism, isn't it, really?
Well, not yeah, but sort of saying what's a reasonable measure, and certainly you need a government sector which grows at the same rate as the economy itself is growing, to sort of maintain the current size and balance, and that implies a deficit of about 3% of GDP, 3 to 6%. It doesn't imply 20%, 30%, and 40%. So if you did it, and you then also reduce the encouragement people face right now to go into private debt because they're anticipating capital gains out of levered speculation. I think a lot of that was driven by the government taking money out of circulation anyway, and not creating enough in the first place, and then leading to the sort of damaging speculation we've seen. With the government creating more money in a more regular way, I think it'd have less of that temptation to get into private sector debt and less volatility, which would give you less need to worry about the issues we spoke about in the first place.
I wonder whether central banks can have a role in trying to hold things back. You know, it feels like the idea of having two forces working side by side, not pulling apart, which is often the way, isn't it, between monetary policy and fiscal policy. Because in normal times, you might think, well, okay, there's too much fiscal policy, so the central bank pushes up interest rates, thereby negating any of the benefits of that fiscal policy. I mean, that is just a nonsense when they work against each other. But if they work together, and then one is there just as a controlling influence. So I'll give you an example. I heard an interview with Sir Paul Tucker this week, who is a former deputy governor of the Bank
of England.
Is
Tucker sumptuous, or the Tucker's pretty basic? pretty ordinary
we're
Tucker.
We're talking about Lord Sumption. If you missed it, we were talking about Lord Sumption last week, who was basically saying old people's lives aren't worth as much as young people's. And we called him Lord Sumption, in case you missed it. So, yes, Sir Paul Tucker, who you do imagine him, it's sort of like in a rather large belly tucking into his food, don't you? But anyway, he's a former deputy governor of the Bank of England. He says, you might like him, so let's not degrade him. He says, fiscal policy should be taking the burden of stimulating the economy, with central banks only there as a check if things go wrong, because monetary policy is pushing on a string. I've heard that expression before. Mm-hmm. But we know, he says, central banks do a good job of constraining the economy if they need to. So he's talking about interest rates, obviously, isn't he? Could that work? So if the government is there and it's applying modern monetary theory and it's pumping more money into the economy, but it's pumped in too much, would pushing up interest rates solve that problem?
No, and this is where Minsky's insights into a world of fundamental uncertainty versus the Elon model of a world where the future is certain and all you're doing is changing your discount rate. The whole idea of interest rates reducing economic activity is based on the idea that we all have a rate of time discount. And if there's an increase in interest rate, it's worth our while as savers to hang on to money because we're going to get more for it in the future. And if you're valuing an investment project, you're going to use a higher discount rate. So the high interest rate will reduce the level of investment. And that sees the interest rate as a sort of fine tuning mechanism on the level of investment. But as Keynes argued very clearly back in the general theory, and plenty of post Keynesians have added in since, We live in a world of fundamental uncertainty. You don't know the future by any stretch of imagination. In that case, the most important thing which is going to determine how much you invest are your expectations of profit, not the interest rate you've got to use as a discount. So if you're going to make interest rates have an impact, then you've got to make it like a club on the scale of what Fokler did back in the 1980s, dramatically increasing interest rates so much that the financial costs of that caused lots of companies to fail and caused a recession. So it's not a fine-tuning instrument
but
at all.
What about what it does to house prices? Because based on what you've just said, everyone has this strange belief that house prices will always go up and therefore they're always going to profit from it. So even if I'm paying more interest in the short term, that doesn't matter because when I sell a house, it's going to be worth so much more than it did when I bought it. And yet, when interest rates do go up, we do get a short-term response that fewer people buy houses. I mean, it does slow down asset price inflation, doesn't it? And maybe that's the only thing central banks need to do.
Well, that's the thing that they've ignored, actually, and they've actually helped cause central
banks. Yeah, no, exactly. And they say it's not their job, in fact, to be concerned about that.
But quantitative easing was you can actually quote Bernanke, I think, from 2009, maybe 2010, that the objective of QE was to drive up asset prices. Mm. So far from not taking them seriously, they didn't worry about they don't worry about asset prices rising. They encourage them to rise.
Well, that's because they have this belief that that money is going to trickle down, that the people who benefit
from Lord Sumptuous onto Lord Tucker.
Via Lord Tucker.
From Sumptuous onto the Tucker, yeah.
down to us mere mortals of lesser value. Mm. But we know that's not the case. I'm still trying to find the central bank. If we accept the fact that central banks do have a role, are they literally there just to make sure other banks don't fall over and all the rest of it falls on the government?
I think in the sense of being the organization that has to administer the financial sector, yeah, largely. That's probably their vital role. Interest rate setting, fiscal policy, targets for the level of private debt, et cetera, you might get some specialization amongst them, but the decisions have to be at the political level.
Right. And will we get there, given that we are so much closer to it than we have ever been, you know, for decades?
Well, I mean, I never thought I'd need to update my work on a modern debt jubilee because I thought it had, you know, two chances of happening, Buckley's and none, for those who don't know they're Australian. And now, of course, it's looking like it's actually to some extent feasible in the aftermath of COVID. So, yeah, these things can happen. But, again, it's so outside the realms of possibility for sensible policy to apply that I have a hard time even considering it.
And Janet Yellen as the new Treasury Secretary in the US, is that a good thing or a bad thing? What are your thoughts on that?
Pretty pedestrian. I mean, not as pedestrian as Bernanke, but she's not a sprinter in comparison either. My favourite give on her was that too. She did speak once at the Jerome Levy Institute in upstate New York, which was the centre that actually sponsored Hyman Minsky for most of his final years. In fact, I spent my sabbatical there back in 2000, writing Debunking Economics in Hyman Minsky's office. That's one of the highlights of my intellectual career. Anyway, there was an annual Hyman Minsky conference held at Bard College, and she attended, I think, in about 1997. And her topic was how fantastic it was that we've developed derivatives because this can control risk in the financial sector. And that's a pretty good start. You know, bang, so CDOs blow up and destroy the known world in pretty much the year she spoke, then 2000, then 2007. Mm. So she came back after the financial crisis, about 2009, I think, and spoke at another conference. And there she sort of did a mea culpa for getting it wrong the last time. But she actually quoted Minsky. Now, I don't like him. Painful little bastard. I said, which Minsky paper did she quote? Went to look. I've never seen that one before. And then I went, it was virtually handwritten note that was stored on the digital resources of Bard College. So I think all that happened was she said, I need a quote from Minsky. I need a paper from Minsky. Can somebody find me a Minsky paper? And a bunch of economists who don't even know that Minsky used to publish in academic journals went searching through the Jerome Levy Institute, found that link for her and put it in her bibliography. So I think she knows bugger all about Minsky.
But she might be learning. I mean, it seems like she's come a long way.
So why do we put slow learners is in charge of economic policy.
Well, maybe because we don't know what to look for. I mean, she was this week, last week, I should say, talking about in the hearing before she was made the given a new gig. She was
Treasury Secretary,
saying that we should spend big. She didn't seem too concerned about how that money was going to be paid back. Maybe she's
possible. I mean, having put her down beforehand, I haven't read anything she's written in recent years, and I don't think you'd actually necessarily see it in what they write either, because there's an extent to which central banks, certainly prominent ones, are controlled in what they can actually let be published. They don't want to scare the horses by letting it know that they run, might have read Stephanie Kelton, for example.
Exactly.
So there is a possibility of some hidden learning that's gone on there that we're not party to.
And she was saying yeah. even before Jerome Powell came on the scene, and then Jerome Powell picked up the same line. We've done as much as we can now. It's up to the government. It's up to fiscal stimulus. I mean,
that's the interesting thing. Mm. Yeah, it comes back and bites. For the people who argued for central bank independence in the past were central bank bankers and neoclassical economists who thought that'd mean they'd be in charge and therefore everything would be fantastic.
Yeah.
Well, they are in charge and it's been a total stuff up.
Yeah. And then they say, well, and we've done as much as we can now. It's over to you guys. Monetarism isn't working for us.
Thank you for the hot potato. You can have it back.
Yeah. What a shame Friedman isn't here to tell us what he thinks. But mm-hmm. yeah, he'll be won't be turning in his grave. He'll be going, thank God I'm out of that game.
I think so.
Good to talk, Steve. Catch you again next week.
Okay, mate. Bye.
Not sure what we're going to talk about next week, though. So maybe that's a chance for you to jump in before we think of something. You can Twitter is probably the best place to find us at Phil Dobby or at Professor Steve or Prof Steve Keen. That's it for this week, though. I'm Phil Dobby. Back again with Steve next week. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
If you've enjoyed listening to Debunking Economics, even if you haven't, you might also enjoy The Y Curve. Each week, Roger Hearing and I talk to a guest about a topic that is very much in the news that week. It's lively, it's fun, it's informative. What more could you want? So search The Y Curve in your favorite podcast app or go to ycurve.com to listen.